This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. From time to time, we talk about the very end of life and how to handle the process. Our guests are the creators of a new edition of a book on people seeing out their final days in their homes instead of hospitals. Dr. Andrea Sankar and Caitlin Cassidy are the co-authors of Dying at Home, a Family Guide for Caregiving. Dr. Sankar is a professor of medical anthropology at Wayne State University, also the co-founder and co-director of the Social Work and Anthropology Doctoral Program. Welcome, Dr. Sankar.
Glad to be here.
Caitlin Cassidy is a PhD candidate in Social Work and Anthropology at Wayne State University and has worked with chronically ill and dying people in California, Oregon, and Michigan. Welcome, Caitlin.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Andrea, this is the third edition of the book. Has much changed in this field in recent years?
Yes, a lot has changed. There's a lot more access to reimbursement from both Medicare and Medicaid, as well as private insurance. As well, the treatment for pain at home has improved dramatically and has the technology that allows people to receive other kinds of treatment at home while they're dying. So much has changed in those years.
Is that partly because we've gotten a little less reluctant to talk about things we can do for people in their final days?
I would hope so, but I think it's more sort of from the bottom up, where providers as well as families have demanded that change take place. I think we still are not talking about death and the dying process as much as would benefit the whole society.
Now, I notice you both come in with anthropology credentials. I mean, Caitlin, have you studied approaches to death in many cultures?
Yeah, I have. I have a bit, although I will tell you, Jeffrey, I think that around here in North America, in particular, the United States, is interesting enough to fill an entire dissertation.
Is that going to be your dissertation, in fact?
Actually, I study medical aid in dying, so I interviewed a few physicians close to home for you in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. So people used to die at home before we had big modern hospitals. Is there a bit of a movement here to take it back?
In some ways, yes, there is. I mean, the hospice movement that started in England 50-some years ago tried to get people out of the home out of the hospital and into the home. And so that movement is becoming much more widespread, as well as the financial incentives from the hospitals are now saying they don't want it or they are unable to care for somebody in the last stages of life. So there's a push from hospitals to get people out of the hospitals into either home care or skilled nursing facilities and occasionally standalone hospices.
Now, Andrea, there are case studies in the book of people to remind us how rewarding this can be for a caregiver and dying person. But some of these also point out cases where people didn't go quietly and lovingly. There is a bit of a range there, isn't there?
Quite a bit. The care for the dying is a real challenge for families and for individuals. If there's been any kind of tension and disagreement in families, it's likely to come out under the pressure of caring for a dying family member. And so, yes, many of these cases that we profile in the book went very well, but many of them really unearthed some tensions that hadn't been dealt with before and that came out in the dying process. And that's where being enrolled in hospice can be hugely helpful, because hospices have access to hospice social workers, and they're the ones who can help families deal with some of these underlying issues so that the caregiving and the dying experience can be better for everybody.
Is that a major bottom line for you in the book? Hospice really should be part of the process?
Yes. Not should in the sense of a moral should, but should in the sense of it will dramatically help the caregiver as well as the dying person go through this process and come out so that the caregiver isn't as overwhelmed both emotionally and physically as one would be if they tried to do this by themselves.
Yeah, an important thing to note, of course, that I'm reminded of every time we have conversations about late-in-life care is that the patient hasn't been through it, the people around them generally haven't been through it, the people in hospice have. They've seen the process before.
That's exactly right. Unfortunately, as you pointed out earlier, the care for the dying has really moved into hospitals in the last 100 years. So that most people actually have not seen someone die and certainly have not been part of the caregiving process. So we try to convey in the book the idea of what the experience is actually like, both for the person who's dying and for the caregiver, so that people have a better sense of what to expect when they start caring for somebody who's dying.
Andrea Sankar and C.M. Cassidy are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-authors of Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving, a reprint now in its third edition. I've heard many a guest, Caitlin Cassidy, say these conversations really should happen long before anyone is even sick. But how often do people heed that advice?
You know, I think it's actually not as often as you would hope, and probably not as deeply as you would hope either. You know, I hear a lot of folks say, you know, my kids know what I want, or my spouse knows what I want. And it's sort of this, you know, tacit sort of this expected, you know, maybe they saw somebody else pass on, or, you know, they've had little discussions here and there about how it'll look or what will go on. And I think that it just isn't enough. And, you know, advanced directives and the patient-centered care movement, they've really tried to shift that. You know, there's been a few folks here and there, big cases about, you know, folks like Terry Schiavo and incidences like that that have moved people to talk more about it. But I still don't think it's enough. And sometimes just having that conversation, not even really just putting it down on paper, but having that conversation person to person can generate an ongoing conversation and understanding about what folks expect in terms of care and what they want.
Do some people not have a choice? Do they have to care for people at home because of financial circumstances or other?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Dr. Sankar sort of suggested that a little bit before, you know, that in some cases, it's not really a choice in that, you know, the hospital, maybe they've been in the hospital and the hospital says, you can go home on hospice or you can go to a nursing facility on hospice. And for folks who don't have Medicare or OHP or aren't eligible for some reason, they can't go to a nursing home, or maybe they don't want to. They don't like those options. And so often, because we're no longer set up to allow people to die in the hospital as easily as before when it was expected before hospice started, they're in this situation that they didn't expect, caring for someone who's dying at home.
Now, Dr. Sankar, if people do want to die at home and have a willing partner or team to support them, what are some of the typical setbacks for them?
The actual care itself is often a setback. As somebody gets closer to death, the amount of care they require increases, typically, not always, but typically it does. And although it may seem obvious, people who are dying are very, very sick. And that means that they require sometimes around-the-clock care. They often don't sleep. They may have psychological problems so that they appear to be very anxious. And so the actual hands-on care that the family caregivers have to provide can be quite onerous. And so that's where hospice can come in to help, but it's only partial help. It really relies on the informal caregivers, either family or friends that do it, and it's a lot of work.
So just the supply and demand, we've talked about shortages in many medical fields in other conversations. I mean, are there any issues with people getting the in-home care or at least getting support for the caregivers? How's the supply of people to do that?
You know, I don't know any national numbers on that per se in terms of hospice or private caregivers that might be hired or folks that provide caregiving even through like Medicaid funds or things like OHP. But I do know on an anecdotal basis, I've run into a lot of folks saying that there are not possibly since COVID, you know, there are not enough people. For instance, a nursing home was working solely on contract or travel. Folks who do travel care here in Michigan the other day, someone told me hospice that was losing its last nurse but still had patients. So I would say anecdotally, there's probably a trend there that follows the trend that is in the United States with other specialties, and that at times it's hard to find trained caregivers. And also the process of finding a caregiver, even when they're available, can be difficult. And you know, psychologically difficult for people to invite somebody into their home to care for someone aside from the financial difficulties.
CM or Caitlin Cassidy and Andrea Sankar are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-authors of Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. Dr. Sankar, you mentioned a moment ago about informal support. There's a section of the book about formal support. What does that mean?
Well, formal support is the support that you pay for. So that's hospice typically. Some people opt not to have hospice, they have home care. So that means that you contract with an agency, a hospice agency or a home care agency. You arrange for them to visit your home on a regular basis. If it's a hospice, the hospice benefit from Medicare is quite defined. A hospice care is supervised by a physician. You have who visits the home maybe once a week, maybe not. They're available 24/7 by phone, but they may not actually be visiting the home. And then you have a hospice aide that comes in for a few hours for a few days a week. So that's the formal care system. And that means that people are in your home that you may not know and that you need to interact with and that you need to work out a working relationship with. The informal care is your family, your friends, your neighbors, you know, work associates, people who pitch in and try to help you. If not help the dying person directly, they try to help the caregiver and help the caregiver be able to help the dying person.
Do you have any recommendations on the size of the support network, like a minimum number of people to have to help surround the caregiver and the person they're providing care to?
Well, that's very difficult because it really depends on how much care the dying person needs. As I said before, some dying people are very peaceful in their death and really do the kind of archetypal, they gently slip away. Others have very, very high care demands. So it really depends on the dying person and what kind of care that they require, as well as the capability of the main caregiver, what kind of other responsibilities, other people they're caring for, full-time jobs that they can't get a leave from. So each situation, I would say, is pretty unique.
You mentioned members of families getting into conflicts. I know what mom wants, that sort of thing. I mean, how resolve those over the care, the feeding, any of it?
I can pick that up. I would say that that it is very, very difficult. I think that having hospice or any knowledgeable, even if you're, you know, hiring private care or you have someone who you know close to you who is knowledgeable about the dying process and things that can happen, such as the difficulty swallowing, the hospice philosophy of offering food but not forcing it, things like this, if you have someone to provide that education gently over and over again, you know, definitely hospice staff, but sometimes others, and to provide that education in a way that is gentle, reassuring, and consistent so that family members can understand what the dying person really needs to have a peaceful and as comfortable as possible death, that can help. You know, that can help resolve those, decisions around what to do with hospice and medical care decisions. You know, it doesn't always help the family dynamics themselves, obviously.
So within families, what about children? How much do you guys recommend exposure or inclusion or exclusion for children?
Well, in the in-depth case studies that we did, children were always included. And to the extent that the idea was to see how much a child wanted to be involved. I mean, did a child want to see their grandmother when she was dying or their father when he was dying? And children typically would say very clearly, I want to be part of this. I want to do this. I want to give my dad a glass of water, but I don't want to be around, you know, at any other time. So the caregivers would let the children guide them, but children were in all the cases where children were involved, they were in the family, active in the family. They were also involved in some small way or larger way in the care of the dying person.
There's a toward the end of life. I mean, there's a discussion in the book about hastening or slowing death. What, Caitlin, would be some of the reasons for taking either approach?
Well, it really depends on what the dying person wants, I think, first of all, and what they expect, and you know what their sort of trajectory, I guess, of decisions and care and wants have been for their own illness. You know, for some people, it's a choice to stop slowing death in the sense that they're aggressively treating, you know, congestive heart failure or a cancer, and they choose to stop that treatment because they're tired. They can't, you know, handle the side effects of treatment, or, you know, maybe their quality of life is already lost. And in those cases, sometimes people choose to stop slowing it, not to hasten it, to let the natural sort of progress happen. And in hastening it, you know, I would say from the work with the book and my research, a lot of folks just don't want to have that period. They don't want to experience it. You know, they've experienced it with other people. They might have had a not so peaceful experience with a loved one or a family member. Or they just decide, you know, even in Oregon and Washington and other states where it's available to avail themselves of medical aid in dying, or death with dignity, as it's sometimes called in Oregon. So it's a range of decisions. It can be stopping treatment. It can be that slowing it. It can be, you know, actually hastening death in other ways. But it's really a range, and it depends on what's going on in the disease process and what the person that's dying themselves wants.
It is a very thorough book, and people will learn a lot from reading it. It's the third edition of Dying at Home, A Family Guide for Caregiving. This edition written by Andrea Sankar, professor of medical anthropology at Wayne State University. Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you for having us.
And Caitlin Cassidy, PhD candidate in social work and anthropology at Wayne State University. Thank you, Caitlin.
Thank you so much.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. We'll be back.